it's kind of like arranging one's whole life around some drug addiction, right? It's like we've arranged our whole lives around the occasional moment of like kind of riding bareback on a good associative leap. Poetry is a really good habit for people with obsessive minds. After publishing a few books, it really dawned on me, like, oh, publishing is a whole other thing. And it's very little to do with that kind of ironing of sentences that I started with when I was a kid and doing this. It's taken me, you know, 25 years of straight doing this concertedly all the time.
Right.
To feel how I feel about it now, you know?
Right. Hi, welcome to the Roostone House podcast. I'm Bianca Stone. I'm talking today with Craig Morgenthaler. He's the author of three previous books of poetry on top of his newest one, Welcome to Sonnetsville, New Jersey. The Trembling Answers, which won the 2017 Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize from the Academy of American Poets. He's also the author of the essay collection, We Begin in Gladness, one of my favorite books on poetry, hands down. And he teaches creative writing at NYU and Bennington College. He works at the Paris Review, and he lives in New Jersey with his wife and children, his dog, and his hamster. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you. Thank you. Alas, the poor hamster shuffled off the mortal coil about a year ago.
I was going to say, isn't there a long poem about your hamster dying in your book?
There's a, yeah. And there's a whole big essay that's about to come out that basically takes on way more guilt than it should about this poor hamster that it turns out I loved kind of a lot. So,
oh my God. I mean, great or small creatures, they can take on a lot of love for sure. Yeah,
as Auden says, the day of his dying was a dark, cold day.
It was a dark, cold day. My family, yeah. Did you have a proper funeral? Of course you did.
It was a whole ceremony. Simone wrote a poem that was every bit as guilty as I felt. Like it was this it had this marvelously outsized adult guilt in it. And I was like, how did you know?
Well, was there reason to be guilty, or it's just like the usual guilt of death, but nobody,
you know, it was like feeling like, oh God, after a while we decided to move him from the living room to the kitchen because he pooped all over everything, and then we stopped playing with him as much, and then time passed and we got a dog, and then we felt like, oh, we found him dead, you know. Like,
oh God, I don't want to laugh, but I the regret.
Stonehouse podcast on the death of hamsters.
Well, I think it's an appropriate place to start.
It is.
In talking about your book, which is filled with guilt and death, I guess.
Yeah, it's not like I sort of made that up for the hamster.
I don't know what happened. I just, all of a sudden, I was so guilty and upset about the hamster.
I had been just carefree up until then.
That really broke me. Okay. So your new book is so great. And one thing I really loved about it, I mean, I related a lot to the depression and the alcoholism and the forced reconciliation with childhood that one comes up against when they have their own children. Mm-hmm. And they sort of are looking bewildered and stunned at their child as they develop and grow. And then they're sort of reflecting back and seeing themselves in their children, feeling like their parents, that, you know, and all the complexities of that, if you've had a hard childhood, is a very unique experience. So I wondered, however much you feel comfortable with talking about the process of writing this book, what was the experience like, how it came to be, you know, how the poems began, and maybe how it differed from the other books.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the mind-boggling thing about what you just said about sort of confronting your past and your children is that I think what I keep coming up against is the realization that now, having learned all these lessons, I don't actually get to go back and apply them to my own childhood, you know?
Right.
And that seems like a terrible injustice. It seems like, okay, if you go through all this crap, you know, and like have your kids and raise them, you should at least get to go back to your childhood, like maybe when your kids are bigger, and just make it happy, you know?
You want to parent yourself, right?
Right. So I think, I mean, the book came about because we moved out of the city, out of New York City, and moved to the suburbs in New Jersey, mostly because, you know, our son's disabled, and Brooklyn became an impossible place to live with a child in a wheelchair with lots of medical needs. And then we got out here, and it turned out that one, the real nightmare for both Brenda and I, and Brenda Shaughnessy, who's also a poet, you know, we both grew up in the suburbs and thought we're never going back there. You know, it's hell. You know, that's where you go to die. And so we were really both scared, you know, of what it would mean. And so the book really was just me sitting on my deck in our new little house, you know, 6 years ago and 5 years ago, and just trying to get my head around like what it was like to walk back into what I thought was a nightmare and what it turned out not to be. You know, so and then I read Dawn Patterson's 40 poem, 40 sonnets. And I don't know why that book kicked me off so profoundly, but it's just this book of 40 sonnets. And he tries sonnets in a bunch of different ways, and they're skinny and they're fat and they're correct and they're broken, and they're imaginative and they're kind of reportage. And it just somehow got my brain spinning. I mean, and this wasn't the first time I got addicted to writing sonnets, but so I just sat there for a year and wrote probably 100 sonnets. I would just sit down for my nightly pipe smoking time on my deck and try to start three or four sonnets and see where they would go. And it really ended up being just like they were like a way of externalizing this kind of like processing of this stuff. And so I did that for about a year, and then other shapes of poems started coming. That one about my mom, you know, coming in the afterlife in a van, in a kidnapper van to pick me up, was sort of a milestone, kind of where I was like, oh, okay,
It's
something else is
huge.
happening
Yeah, it's
here.
huge.
And then I realized most of the sonnet, you know, I thought it would be a book of sonnets, and then I realized that most of them sucked, and that I only had like, you know, 20 that I'd be willing to show anybody. So then I dumped in this chapbook that Omni Dawn had asked me to write in 2012 that I've been trying to find a book for. So that's the prose poems. And then that long poem at the end, you know, was just, I was sitting there on the deck one day listening to somebody have a party next door and realizing that everybody doesn't spend the better part of their time thinking about when they're going to die, and that I thought they were missing out, so wanted to think about it for them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really a, I mean, there's so much you just said, but just that last bit is a strange blessing for poets to be, or even just people to be extremely introspective on the larger issues of being a organism on this planet. Yet it comes obviously with a lot of struggle.
But at least we get free poems in exchange, you know,
We do. We get
whereas
to
regular
share.
people just get nothing.
All right, Ryan, we have a little bit of a payoff there. It seems like I love how sonnets can do that to poets. You know, I've seen this, you know, one could write an essay. I'm sure there are many essays on poets and their sonnet fevers. I liked that this book actually wasn't a book of all sonnets. So, Sonnetville, New Jersey. The book with a title like that, it definitely creates its own landscape for sure. So that makes a lot of sense. You know, moving out of the city is such a huge deal. Having children is such a huge deal. Moving back into your the vistas of your childhood is a huge deal. All those things come together. and you can't help but kind of think like there's this unconscious or subconscious need on the poet's part to face these things and to really get in. You know, you use the obsessive images that keep coming back are digging. Mm-hmm. Digging in the ground, digging in the dirt, creatures of the ground, worms, naked mole rats. It was the lizards, digging dogs.
I didn't even realize that, but you're totally right.
You didn't?
No.
And then the last line, the bottom, no one can dig forever. I feel like there's always such an incredible journey that happens in the creation of a manuscript, and then the editing of the manuscript. Was there anything that stood out?
I mean, it was the other backdrop to the book is, of course, the Trump years, you know? And so when the book finally came out, I suddenly realized, like, oh God, it's a pandemic book, you know, totally unintentionally, but like, it's a book in which, you know, the book almost never leaves the house. The characters are really just my family. And while the pandemic sort of amplified all of those things, that's really what the Trump years felt like, I think, for a lot of us, you know, that it was just sort of these horrible facts kind of encroaching and closing in around us, and then having to, you know, figure out who your people are, you know, and it ends up being this very closely huddled circle. And I think I'm just really surprised now, looking at the book, that I've made this kind of imaginative corral with just my little people in it, which, you know, ended up being the way of life in the year that the book came out. It was as if Trump kind of led to that, you know, the pandemic was of him or something.
I know, it was you're totally right, a very one for the history books for sure, this era.
Yeah,
you know, and the COVID's like took over in our minds, but remembering right when you're saying that, I'm remembering back to the Trump years, and it was just as much uncertain as a plague. Just no idea how long it's gonna last, and what, you know, like, you know, nations fall, you know, nations have fallen in the past. Are we gonna be alive? And
we may well be, you know. It's not over, but at least that absurdity of like, what did Trump say while I was sleeping right now, that's not what I wake up to every day.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to read. Let's read one from the book. So slightly inclined to read the mother poem, but maybe that's too much to start with. What do you feel?
I don't know. I don't think poems are for being fun or happy or anything. I don't know. I think that poem's fun.
Okay, cool. Was it Dream I Never Had, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, on page 30. If you have your books at home, please turn to page 30.
I guess I'm supposed to read it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You know what's a problem I really didn't solve with this poem that I really wish I had is the quotation mark problem. It looks like it needs a haircut, but it's just that it's full of quotation marks. And I wish I tried the italics, but it didn't look right. So I just
wanted... We'll talk about it after.
Sorry.
No, don't be sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry. Okay, a dream I never had, in which a van pulls up the dark driveway, its long lights parting the heavy night. The side door slides open, and there is my mother beckoning. Quick, she says, get in before your father finds out I'm not dead anymore. Don't you want to meet your grandkids? I ask. There isn't time for that, and you won't miss them where we're going. Where are we going? Back, obviously, to redo everything better. I want to be happy this time, she says. What will I do? I ask. I'm too old to be your son. We'll see, she says, but we have to go now. Come on, Marcia. I hear someone hiss from the driver's seat. Come on, says my mom. Daddy, I hear Simone calling from just inside the house. I have to check, Mom. Wait, please, I say. But already the van is backing out, the light recoiling. Already I'm awake.
Beautiful. It is, you know, this is a dialogue poem, obviously. And I know what you mean about feeling like trying to get the quote thing right. You know, you never know if you're going to go for the quotes or not.
Yeah, but I didn't know how to, like, you can't have two voices in italics. That just makes it, quote's the only thing that worked.
It's the only, yeah. And they don't have time to be confusing. It's like a James Tate poem. He's like, has to have right. quotes.
Yeah, you can't be talking.
Well, so, what were you going to say?
Oh, it's a fast moving poem. It kind of gets in and gets out.
It is fast moving. And it's in the second section, which is called A Dream. And I thought it was a really kind of, I'm thinking a lot of dreams. I've been thinking a lot of dreams in the past week and poetry. And so I was thrilled to find this section. And I thought it made reading the whole section really interesting because I wasn't sure what was a dream that you were expressing in the, that the speaker was expressing in the poem, or what was just that blurry, I mean, they're all sort of the blurry line between reality and dream, and dreams are reality, I think, but poem to poem, you know, there's always a question as to whether or not we're in a dream or not. So mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool. Was this a dream?
No, but it came, like, it kind of came whole, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, I was sitting out on my deck, and it just, I was like, oh shit, my mom's gonna come in and kidnap a van and try to get me to go with her back to wherever. I mean, it just sort of plopped out, and yeah. And it felt very handed to me. So, you know, and it was, I mean, that title, like, you know, so my mom died when I was 14, and I have fairly regularly since then had occasional dreams in which she comes back to life. And always in those dreams, she's like some provisional thing has been done that allows her to precariously come back to life. But like, she might die at any time, and she's not particularly happy to be back because it's not natural and it's not right. And I'm like desperate, you know, so it was, it sort of grew out of this
right.
series of dreams that I've had for, you know, 25 years. But I've never had that one.
Well, there was no doubt in my mind that was the case. I lost my grandmother, and I have such similar dreams than that, you yeah, know, yeah. this, that line, quick, she says, get in before your father finds out I'm not dead anymore. Just that sort of anxiety of like her knowing she's dead or other people knowing she's alive, or, you know, like just this, I think it's almost like, you know, the mother is a really interesting ghost in this book. She's not over, she doesn't oversaturate the book. But she is in some ways the power behind the poems.
Well, it's, you know, it's sort of her environment that it's the environment in which she raised me that the book narrates my moving my kids into.
You mean the New Jersey landscape?
I mean, the suburbs. I didn't grow up in Jersey. I grew up outside of New York. But yeah, just the suburbs and the kind of little friendly nightmare of the suburbs.
So this is really interesting. So it, you know, I'm thinking about, we were talking in the last podcast about the multiple self states of a human being, and how that's a psychologically significant discovery for somebody to accept that they have multiple selves and not just one self. But it's obviously in poetry, we're able to accept maybe our multiple selves more readily in the fact that we can say they're a speaker and have a little bit of fun distancing ourselves from that self.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's really interesting that you would put it in such a way that you were inhabiting the space of your mother in the book, in these poems. You know, I think you say in one poem where you're taking Simone to school and you're standing there and you said, "I'm my mother and she's me." And there was just something really, I mean, both the like, also the like male female swap there.
Yeah. No, you know, it's like, I feel like this has just been this era of understandably really politically the poetry has come forward in the public sphere in this different way, and there's been a lot of imperative things that poets have had to talk about. And I think just in the last few years, it seemed really important to me to speak about the dizzying experience of parenthood really, really directly while this is going on. And while our generation has these little kids, you know, and while we're sitting here and looking at a world that is obviously even more fucked up than the one that was left to us is the one that we're bringing our kids into. And it just, I don't know, I keep trying to figure out, is this a pressing enough subject in a way, given everything that's going on, you know, to think about like walking your kid up the hill to school, and especially doing it in a nice suburb, you know, but I don't know. I feel like there's just the parenthood squeezes all the other stuff out of you, you know. It just, you end up just kind of all over your, just your whole inner life falls out all over your outer life. Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like that's important.
It is important. I mean, think about it. It's like ground zero for life, right? Yeah. Reproducing a universal aspect of life being on the planet too. And I think it, what you point towards in this book is mortality. You know, the moment you have children is the moment you start saying, okay, now it's the next generation's turn, and I will train them to be a Jedi, and I will step aside, you know, as master.
Right. And we were, the book that Simone and Brandon and I are reading at bed, I can't remember the title right now, but it was talking about family trees, or was it a show we were watching? I don't know. But it just occurred to me, like, wow, if you make a family tree, until you have kids, you're the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you're just in the middle of it, you know? And that's a sort of dizzying thought.
It's so true. That's so true. It is a dizzying thought.
You become, rather than the result of the continuum, just another part of it.
Right. And that's hard to accept.
Yeah.
Maybe why some people can be so cruel to their, you know, one reason to be cruel to your children is this sort of like feeling usurped at your place at the root, or I guess the tip of the tree.
And if they're not an extension of you, if they fail to extend you in the way you want, that could be a nightmare. You're waiting for it. If you can't give up your position.
Yeah, and I think for a poet to have a child too is I hate this sentimental, but like there is some sort of parallel between like creating poems and creating children. I don't know. But you do sort of make it and send it out into the world and hope that it represents you in some sort of way.
Yeah. And you have to manage the ways in which you project yourself onto both
things, yeah,
right? I mean, and you can get away with a lot more self-projection on a poem and keep it healthy than you can on a child, which is maybe one reason why it's good to be a poet if you have children, because you can exorcise those demons in the poems a little bit so that you don't do it so much on your kids.
Oh, that's so true. That's so true. Play out the shadow on the poem. Mm-hmm. I want to read another one.
Okay. I just want to point out that when you say you want to read it, you actually want me to read it. You want me to do the work.
No, I'm happy to read.
No, them. That would be no. I'm just saying it's. I'm not saying.
No. I'm saying like.
Let's just fix this in post. Yeah. This is terrible.
No, it's not. I'm not fixing.
No, I know.
I'm here to humiliate you. That's my job.
I'm just trying to display some of that trademark guilt, you know, that we were talking about before. I just want to make sure I get that on here. What do you want me to read? This is fun taking requests.
Let's see. Maybe one from the, how about the immortality one?
Totally. This, by the way, I just want to show this since there's a video. This is Brenda and Simone made me a cake of the cover.
Oh my.
This is the font lettering, and they actually did a really accurate job of making the cover on a cake. I was just thrilled.
You mean they did it like by hand, not like a
they
images blotches. Printed on cakes.
No, they like used fondant and they like made little blotches for the different.
Oh my god, that's so cool. I have a picture of it sweet. That's so sweet.
Okay, immortality. This is probably almost a 10-year-old poem now, which is really wild.
Oh, wow.
I feel like Emily Dickinson did, running her pale finger over each blade of grass and caressing each root in the depths of the earth's primeval dirt, each tip tickling heaven's soft underbelly. I feel like Emily alone in her room, her hands folded neatly in her lap, waiting forever for one of those two daguerreotypes to embalm her unprecedented soul. At my most attuned, the present is a pair of wings stretching forever in all directions, flapping calmly, calmly flapping. But as soon as I notice how happy I am, how close to the sun, there I go plummeting into the background of the same damn painting as ever. If I could reach my hand out to you now, would you take it? How do you think it would feel? Warm and soft and certain? Or like Emily's, clammy and brittle as hardened paste? Is that not how you imagine your hands? Look again. They were like that. Otherwise, she could never, would never have written those poems.
I love this poem, and I always love poems that talk to other poets. And then I felt like a little bit of a Keats in here as well. With the this hand now warm and capable, which seems like such a, that poem is such a poem facing mortality. Mm-hmm.
I feel a little bad now. I sort of don't like the suggestion that if you have clammy hands, you write sad poems or something. But I think I was just really thinking of those two pictures of her, you know?
Uh-huh.
And just the quality of the picture, she looks like she's just gonna crack, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love that thought that she just sat up there with her hands in her lap forever. But also I love the thought that she didn't. I don't know. I think Dickinson is just one of those, you know, you could sort of always prescribe Dickinson for any problem. You know, and she knows the solution, which is really just to ask a question and then not have an answer to it. But she's, you know, she's sort of the most punk poet.
Yeah. Totally.
Like ever.
I agree. Unknowable, yet we keep trying so hard to know her.
And so utterly familiar, you know, made of everything America's made of. Mm-hmm. Everything, I mean, you know. But just so deep in her inner life, or so attuned, her inner and outer lives were seemed so attuned, at least in the poems. I don't know.
Absolutely. There, I always feel like there's something otherworldly, like alien about her, even. Mm-hmm. But I always regret saying things that are alien when it's almost like they're so human, they're more human than we are, that it feels alien.
And at some level, you can't get poems more of the world, you know, like she gets down there and puts her eyelashes up against blades of grass, you know, you can't get closer
yeah
than she got, except that you also can't get more into the imagination than she got. Real paradox, that Dickinson.
Yeah, totally. Okay, let's ask some questions. So you write a lot about music. This was, I actually didn't know this about you. Tell me about that a little bit, just your love of music and writing about it. And are you a musician?
Oh yeah, yeah. So behind me right here, maybe that people at home, that's my drum kit.
Cool, yeah.
So I've played drums since I was 12. Mm-hmm. I taught myself a little guitar and took piano lessons for a couple of years. Yeah, music probably occupies 2/3 of my inner life, I think, and mostly jazz, but also it's sort of jazz and kind of in indie rock. But I'm pretty deep into jazz, and I think, well, it, you know, really the core of it for me is something that William Carlos Williams says in one of my favorite poems of his, which is The Orchestra, which is a late poem. And he says, I should get it. I'm going to get it.
Okay.
I don't want to get this wrong because it's such a good quote. And it happens I've been reading Williams lately, and so I have my edition of this poem very handy.
I'm excited.
All right. So Williams says in the orchestra, well, shall we think or listen? Is there a sound addressed not wholly to the ear? We half close our eyes. We do not hear through our eyes. It is not a flute note either. It is the relation of a flute note to a drum. And I first heard that poem when I was a teenager. Williams was my first kind of favorite poet, and I used to have a cassette tape of, you know, I think it was some HarperCollins series of, you know, the poet reads. And I had the tape in my car, and I would just drive around all depressed as a teenager listening to William Carlos Williams read these sort of old poems. But I just, at the same time, you know, shortly after my mom died, unsurprisingly, I got very depressed, and I couldn't listen to music with words at all. I couldn't really feel anything, you know, so music, mm-hmm. As a thing that would let you kind of take off and ride your feelings like little wings into the heavens, didn't work. And so suddenly I was like, well, what can I listen to? And that's when I found jazz, and that's when I found, like, oh, it's music that's not addressed wholly to the ear, right? That there's this other thing that's happening where you're thinking and mm-hmm. listening and feeling all at the same time. And that felt like a really profound kind of change in terms of how I could think about what music was, right? That it's something you can do actively. You can listen to it by thinking about it, and you can let it really preoccupy you the way you would let a poem, right? Where you're thinking at the same time as you're kind of reading, and you're letting it wash over you while also kind of analyzing it. Not that that's, you know, I mean, and I just thought that was so well sort of articulated in the Williams poem, and I've just loved. Yeah, so it's a huge, huge part of my life. If I could, I would be a musician rather than a poet, but I haven't. It was evident from the beginning I did not want to practice that much.
And yeah, that is something with music, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it happens with poetry too. You've got to practice.
But you have to figure out what's the art form you actually like enough to do the boring work on.
100%. 100%. But well, it's good that you can still do music, though. I mean, without the pressure of performing necessarily.
Yeah, no, it makes for a good hobby.
And good for the poetry, you know, that music in your head, and you can write about it. I see you love to write about it. Yeah. It comes into your poems as well. I was just going to point out the obvious at the end of that poem that he was saying that it's a relational process between the drum and the flute. Was it a flute?
Flute note. Yeah. The relation between a flute note and a drum.
Yeah. Which, as we know, is what happens with the poems as well.
Yeah. No, and it's a great way of pinpointing that most frustrating thing, which is that really what we're after is nothing, right? It's not the flute note or the drum. It's this relation between them. So,
right,
you know, it's like the associative leap in a poem. Like, what is that? Like, you can't go fill a basket with it. It's
right.
It's nothing. It's just this.
Yeah, it's nothing.
but it's like the whole thing. It's, you know, we're ever in pursuit of it.
It's so wild. I mean, it is wild when you think about it. The nothing we are in pursuit of.
Yeah. I mean, and that, you know, I mean, it's kind of like arranging one's whole life around some drug addiction, right? It's like we've arranged our whole lives around the occasional moment of like kind of riding bareback on a good associative leap, you know, which like, yeah. Like, you know, I mean, and we write every day for decades and yeah. decades just to
have chasing it
a few times, you know,
chasing it. Oh God. And then it comes and it's so good. And then you're like, kind of devastated afterwards. It's like there's like a calm down.
Oh, a huge one.
There's a crash.
Do you get that after you finish? I mean, you're about to publish your book too. Do you get a long period of shutdown silence after a book? Because I do.
I do. I kind of went through the poetry silence and I'm writing poetry again. My book is now actually getting at the printer, so I can't change anything now, and I'm someone who changes things up until the bitter end. I'm actually still, I think I still may email my editor today and be like, can I change this one word? Is it too late? Is it really too late?
They're gonna incur printing charges. You gotta just let it go. I've read the book. That one word is just fine.
I'm like convinced it's gonna ruin everything.
I know the word you mean, and it's fine.
God, I hope you don't. What was I gonna say? Besides the crash afterwards, the obsessing about stupid shit that doesn't matter instead of being happy about it, is definitely my MO. But yeah, there's like 100, there's like, it's like a depression when you're done with a book, or when you get a poem taken at a magazine you really want and you're so happy and blah blah blah, and then it comes out, and then afterwards you're, I don't know, it's just like, I mean, that's, well, I'm getting into a little bit of mental illness here, because it's actually a problem if you do that too much.
Yeah, but
if you put too much stock in the good feeling and not reality, then
sure. No, definitely. I mean, but you know, and not to you know, at some level, I think we got to take mental illness for granted when we're talking too much about poetry. I mean, I don't mean that. I mean that poetry is a really good habit for people with obsessive minds, you know, because you can just keep moving the pieces around. And I think that depression comes at the point at which the toy is totally frozen and you can't move the pieces around anymore. And suddenly the mind, which is kind of like Pac-Man, you know, it's like, it just needs to eat those little pellets. And then suddenly when there are no more pellets, it just eats itself, you know? And so then if it takes you 6 or 8 months or a year to start writing again, you sort of spend all that time eating yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean that certainly is a great source of grief to me. It's like when the mojo isn't there to make some poems, I just start eating myself, and I'm just like, well, it sucks.
It's an awful, awful, awful feeling to not be writing.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there needs to be long periods of not writing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess, you know, there needs to be periods of not feeling great. I guess the problem comes when you let it win or something, like when you don't start writing again, because it can be like anything, you get scared to do it. Like working out. Once you're doing it, you're like, oh yeah, this is fine, this is easy, I got this, you know. You write one good poem and you're back, you know.
Right. Well, right. You're both right. If you write one good poem, you're like, I'm going to write the best book ever made. And I'm going to, you know, I mean, it's one of the things I like about playing a musical instrument. When the kind of inspiration part fails, you can just focus on the mechanical part, which I find much harder to do with poems, you know, because while there is, you do need to spend time focusing on the mechanical part of writing, it's boring in a way that maybe the mechanical part of playing an instrument is not quite as boring. I mean, that you need a subject in poems. You don't need a subject if you're just running through a two-measure drum exercise that you...
And we're not going to like sit around like scanning lines in a formal poem to like keep and sharp.
No, and that doesn't solve the problem in the way that, you know, but working on something in a musical instrument does at least occupy that little Pac-Man for a while.
Yeah.
That's good.
Two things came to my mind. One is that you did write an incredible book on poetry that could be kind of like practice, you know, like thinking about how poetry works.
Which is a huge reason for why I did it. You know, that was a 5-year project and I could dive into it whenever I needed to.
Five years of writing it?
Yeah. I mean, from the time that it was accepted to when it came out. Yeah, it's about 5 years.
So did you, she says, completely curious, did you think to yourself, I want to write a book on poetry, and then you made a proposal and proposed it to Grey Wolf? Or
I think I'd always wanted to, you know, since I was a teenager, I love, you know, the Poets on Poets books, and I love just people's books of essays on poetry. And I just thought how fun it would be to write one of those. And then, you know, 10 years into being a book critic, I had a bunch of essays. At some point somewhere, Jeff Schatz just said, hey, if you ever have sort of a manuscript, you know, send it to me. And I sent him this thing that he said, no, not this. and I think that happened like twice before finally we settled on like a plan for this book that he thought would work. And then, you know, then I sort of had to shape it up. And then eventually I got a contract, and then there was about 3 years of back and forthing with him, and just fleshing out the book. Prose is hard. It's got a lot of words in it. It's much harder than writing poetry.
You've got to have thesis statements at the beginning of your paragraphs and stuff.
And paragraphs in your paragraphs. Yeah, I mean, it was really hard, and I'm not dying to do it again, I'll admit.
But I bet you will.
Maybe.
I wanted to ask you something about sort of related to that book, also related to teaching. You wrote, there's so many great quotes in this book that I use all the time in my teaching. But this little bit about revision, the initiating impulse behind all poems is perhaps the irresistible need to say things right, such that, as Frost says, they'll be hard to get rid of. Poetry begins at the end, and poetry begins and ends in revision, which can be a lifelong process of replacing the less true words with truer ones. I do a lot of talking with people about their poems and revising. And I wondered, it's always helpful to talk about on the podcast how you speak to your students about revision. How do you balance honoring what they're doing or what they have done and sort of are presenting to you? Here's my finished poem. And like, how do you break it to them that like, they need to rethink how they think about revision and get back in there?
That's a hard thing to do. And I don't know that I'm completely successful at talking about that, but I think my metaphor for it is the idea of a toy, right? I mean, that a poem remains a toy as long as you can change things. And it's one of the few toys we get as adults, right? Mm. Like something that like really we can purely play with. We really, you know, we experiment with it. You know, we're like, what happens if I move this sentence here? And we do that for no other reason than for aesthetic pleasure or because we like to, you know, we enjoy the feeling of figuring out how to kind of smooth over the bump in a clause so that it works. And so I tend to think about revision as like, how long can you keep this thing a toy before mm-hmm. it calcifies and it's not fun anymore, you know? And I try to help people think of it that way. Like the more you revise, the longer it stays fun. Before it becomes that sort of
so boring. Getting them just like like excited about the idea of revision instead of it being like a punishment.
Yeah.
You're playing with this poem.
Yeah.
Playing with it. Yeah.
Sorry. Somewhere along the way, it became the case that the writing part was fairly unpleasant and the whole thing is the revising part, you know?
I mean, I say that with people with manuscripts all the time, but I can't emphasize enough that by the time I've got to my third full-length book of poetry, it really hit home to me that the fun part of putting a manuscript together is editing it. And putting it together is sort of like, okay, here's all the poems I've written in the past 5 years or whatever. I get to like really, like the revision is where I actually, the energy comes into the poetry itself. And I write, I'm not just like moving things around. I'm like writing into it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, something else that I think a lot is that, you know, a sculptor or somebody who makes things out of materials, you know, they go and they buy their material, right? So they go to the lumber yard and get a bunch of wood, or they go to the clay store and get a bunch of clay. You know, for us, we first have to generate that raw material, which is words, right? And words put in some order so that we can reorder them in the right order. So actually there's the phase of it where you generate the material, right? Which is writing. And then there's the phase of it where you make the art object, which is really revision out of that material, you know? And obviously many times the generation phase results in a near finished piece, but many other times the discoveries all happen far away from that generating time, that all the fun happens later.
Right, we get so obsessed with like writing it and it being done so we can publish it.
Yeah, and that's the least fun, you know? And I think after publishing a few books, it really dawned on me like, oh, publishing is a whole other thing. And it's mm-hmm. very little to do with that kind of ironing of sentences that I started with when I was a kid doing this. It's fairly unpleasant. It makes one crazy. And it makes one feel inadequate all the time to publish things. Or it makes you feel like, for 20 minutes, you're like, I'm a god. And then you're like, oh, wait, no, I'm not. I'm just.
Or you're like, wow, all this like emphasis on getting published, and it's actually just not that big of a deal.
Right. It's like they're using a really big printer and glue and like photocopying the pages.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean,
but it's easy for us to say now. I
mean, right. And it's thrilling, you know, and it's thrilling to me that you read these two books and that you, I mean, it's just thrilling. You know, who gets to be read? My God, what an amazing thing. But I also try to convince my students that they need to cleave. And, you know, it's especially when teaching MFA students, and I'm teaching low res MFA students. And so they're sometimes returning students and they're older and they really want to publish something, you know?
Right. They're ready. And they're like, I'm done fucking around. You're like, okay, if you're done fucking around, let's fucking fix your poems. Like,
right.
And quit writing the same poem, like.
Yeah.
I've gotten like kind of harsh the more I like read people's work.
No, it's tough, and it's like you want to give them access to this thing that we've found, right? Which is like this practice by which we can get at something that feels true and real on a fairly regular basis, you know. Yeah. But it takes a lot of patience to get mm-hmm. there, and it takes a lot of, you know, humiliating yourself in front of
you
when you say something that's just not deep at all.
Totally.
And it's you know, how do you, I mean, it's taken me, you know, 25 years of straight doing this concertedly all the time,
right,
to feel how I feel about it now, you know.
Right.
So you can't tell someone like, well, yeah, just come back in 25 years and you'll be great.
Yeah.
You know, especially if they're 50, you know?
Right. Well, it's about that time to
sing the podcast theme song.
It's cleanup time. It's cleanup.
Yeah, no, Bianca, I really struggle with transitions, and so I really could use a song.
The songs that we sing at the end are poems. Sounded so cheesy.
Oh my god, poems are so cheesy.
It's so stupid. Cheesy. I just love talking to you about poetry, so I hope we can talk again. But I just so admire your poems themselves are so good. I'm so excited about this new book. I'm going to put all the links to buy it on the podcast page. It's one of those books that I read a beginning to end. I really enjoyed the arc of the book. I really enjoyed learning all the things about the speaker and what he's going through and the kind of staggering vulnerability, but without bearing all. You know, there's still like a lot that's left for us to work through and think about and put place ourselves into. And at the same time, like really get a sense of this specific family. So I think as a poet who's also in relationship with another poet, I think that is really unique to all your books, is the conversation between poets that happens, the loving conversation, and that's also a struggle sometimes, but always a real connection with the partner in these books, and the children.
Well, I'm really glad, and you know that I'm equally a fan of your book and can't wait for the world to see it. So
yes,
maybe by the time this airs, they will.
Yeah, I think I'll be airing it sooner than that.
Fine.
Like you're supposed to know when my book's coming out. I want you to read us one of these fabulous poems to sing us out.
Cleanup time.
It's cleanup time. What about the chorus?
All right. It's a weirdie. It's a weirdie. All right, here we go. The chorus. One, it's, you know, the part that repeats, the bit you're supposed to remember, the bit that bears repeating, the part that means something new each time, something different. And the same thing, too, the thing you can't forget that gets stuck in your head. So, like, childhood is endless and over almost as soon as it begins. Yeah. Like that, 10 years shrinks like the pages of a water-damaged book. No, the pages don't really shrink or shrivel, they crinkle, get kind of crisp and brittle, but time's like that, a wrinkle, and suddenly you've been married as long as you were ever a kid, ever awash in the interminable Thursday of your first 10 years, when 3 months was an eon, when, like childhood, was endless and over as soon as it began. See what I did there? Shifted the refrain into the middle? Yeah, time is like that, and two, suddenly your newborn is 10 and your wife is celebrating the birthday only grown-ups do, and you must be older than your mom was at your age, and it's not Thursday. Was it ever? And the two pills you have to take every night. How is it Sunday? I mean, Monday, this morning, your alarm, your coffee grumbling, thunder, and the kids, two of them suddenly, are out the door, and their childhood is endless and already over as soon as it begins, and you're on the bus to work. See what I did there? I don't. The four pills you have to take three times every day. You might, three as well, already be at your desk, your deathbed, holding your daughter's grown-up hand. You hope the hospital calm and clean like the one your mother died in. And there's hopefully money somewhere to take care of everything. And this is like childhood, endless and over as soon as it begins, or as close as you'll ever get again. See what I did there? Did you see? Did anyone?
So fucking good, that ending. Craig, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Bianca. Thanks for having me.
Yay.